Ecclesiastes chapter 9. But back up just a moment to chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. So as I said to you, you have all of his raw data, his raw information in chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. In the 7th chapter, he begins answering the question, what advantage does a man have in all the work that he does? This goes all the way back to chapter 1 and verse 3. Chapter 7 and verse 1, he begins with a very simple thing that we ought to all as Christians understand. The most important thing you have in this life and when you leave this life under the sun is, what is your reputation? What reputation did you leave? He says in chapter 7 and verse 1, a good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. If you accomplish something in this life, your life had value, and so your reputation that you have in this life is something you can take with you. That's why the Apostle John in the Revelation said, blessed are those that die in the Lord, that they may rest from their labors and their deeds follow after them. Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount that we need to put up for ourselves things that don't rust and that don't rot and can't be stolen. So there are things that we can take with us. He talks about in chapter 7 why it's important to go to a house of mourning better than a house of feasting. Because the living take it to heart. In chapter 9, he's going to make a statement. The difference between the wise man and the fool is the wise man knows he's going to die. And he makes plans. And the fool doesn't know anything. That's what he says in chapter 9. In chapter 13, verse 13, chapter 7, verse 13. Consider the work of God. When you consider the work of God, you begin seeing everything differently. So he says, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider God has made one as well as the other, so man may not discover anything that will come after him. In the 8th chapter, he comes back to something that he talked about from the very beginning. And I want you to go back to chapter 3. In chapter 3, once he begins talking about God, and that you need to recognize that there's more going on than what you see under the sun, he begins talking about how God does his business. And he says in verse 11, he's made everything appropriate or beautiful in his time. He has set eternity in their hearts so man will not find out the work that God has done. In verse 16, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. Now, if God's in control of everything and he's running everything from heaven and God's providence takes care of things, how can there be injustice? Especially for long periods of time. In chapter 4 and verse 1, I looked under the sun and there were acts of oppression. In verse 2, I congratulated the dead. A person could be so depressed at all of it. If you were to watch the news 24 hours a day, I think anybody would want to jump off their roof. And we have to fix every problem in the whole world. That's a little bit of arrogance, isn't it? That somehow God needs us. I used to think about all the way back to 1948 when Israel became a state. We have to defend Israel because God needs our help because of what is said in the Bible. Can you imagine? When was the last time God needed our help for anything? Now in chapter 8, he comes right back to that. Well, wait a minute now. If God's in control of everything and running the world, and there's no nation that exists except God lets it exist, and God knows the time and the boundaries of the habitations of all nations, and that we need to be very careful in going against our government, because any government, I don't care if you live in Uganda or in America, that government exists because God sees fit that it exists. In chapter 8, he talks about in verse 2, keep the commands of the king because of your oath before God. Not because you like the king or you like the government. I use the example. How much time did Jesus spend trash-mouthing the Roman government when he was on this earth? How much time did the Apostle Paul spend? That wasn't what they were about. They were about saving souls. When you look at Acts 17:26, where he says, God determines the time and boundaries of the habitations of nations. The very next verse, verse 27, says that they should seek him. That's why God does what he does. And oftentimes it's why you and I are at odds with, well, why is God letting this happen or causing this to happen? So he begins talking about in verse chapter 8 and verse 3, do not be in a hurry to leave him, that is the government. Do not join in an evil matter, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps the royal command experiences no trouble, for the wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. And I made a comment. In this country, we're given a privilege. The privilege is we can say anything we want to about the government. We can trash mouth the government. We can put it in writing. We can do whatever we want. A lot of Christians live in environments where they don't have that kind of opportunity. We do. But there will come a time in a Christian's life where you need to say, that's a step, that's a bridge too far. I'm not going to do that. In looking at chapter 9, now you can see he's coming right into the same thought. Verse 1 of chapter 9. For I have taken all of this to heart and do explain to righteous men, righteous and wise men, and their deeds are in the hands of God. So he's moving right into that. Before we move here, I want to go back to a story that we talked about, the book of Daniel. Why don't you look at Daniel chapter 4. So one of the passages that I didn't read in verse 8 was, you just leave things up to God. When it comes to the king, I will tell you, I don't care how powerful the king is, he doesn't know what's going to happen in his future, and he does not know the day of his death. That's how part of how God determines the time and the boundaries of the habitation. In the case of Nebuchadnezzar, what happened to him that he never saw coming? Had to do with his arrogance. It had to do with him putting Christians into fiery furnaces and into lions' dens and being talked into building a 900-foot-tall statue of himself, or 90-foot-tall, I should say. How did God get Nebuchadnezzar's attention? Made him like an animal. You're going to grow long hair and long fingernails, and you're going to live out here like a wild animal, and you're going to eat grass until you recognize something. What did he need to recognize? Who God was. I was at a little get-together not long ago, and there was a little fellow there, about 5 years old, a little boy, and his sister was trying to get him to come to the car. And he jerked back and he said, you're not the boss of me. That's what Nebuchadnezzar thought. Now, in chapter 4 and verse 34, at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, this is chapter 4 and 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. Now, he got his attention. Eventually, I'm going to tell you that Nebuchadnezzar died. Now, before he died, he elevated Daniel to a very prominent position. It's very clear that his son, Belshazzar, had no clue who Daniel was. Yes? God gave him a little nudge to do that. So his son Belshazzar was having a big party, which he tended to a lot. And he looked up and a hand came out of the sky and began writing something on the wall. And it just buckled everybody's knees. They didn't know what was going on. Look in chapter 5 in verse 5. Chapter 5 in verse 5. Suddenly, the finger of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that it did the writing, and the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints were slack, and his knees began to knock together. That's pretty serious, isn't it? Now, eventually they say, hey, there is a man that your daddy knew named Daniel, and he could interpret dreams. Well, get him here, get him here. So he comes in, and he tells Belshazzar the story about his daddy. In chapter 5 and verse 17, I'm not going to read that, but he either tell, maybe Belshazzar didn't know, or maybe he was just reminding him. Let me tell you what God did to your daddy. Then in chapter 5 and verse 22, yet you, O son Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, your heart, even though you knew all of this. And so now he begins in verse 25, mini, mini, tekel of Sharon, I guess, or Sarin. He says, verse 26, this is the interpretation of the message of the hand that wrote on the wall. Mene, mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. You want to know how God determines the time and the boundaries of the habitations of the nations? Look in the next verse. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scale and found what? Wanting or deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Verse 30, that same night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Now let's go back to the book of Ecclesiastes. So throughout all the Old Testament and the New Testament, we are told that there are things that you need to worry about in your life and there are things you don't need to worry about. I call that whittling on God's end of the stick. But exactly what God ought to be doing in Syria and what God ought to be doing in Libya and what God ought to be doing there, it ought to be relatively far from our brain. What ought to be close to our brain is, how do I get to heaven? How do I get my family to heaven? How do I get as many people around me where I brighten the corner where I am? How do I get them to heaven? And I'm going to tell you, that's exactly where Solomon is going to end up in this text. So any comments, questions before we move into, we have our prayer and move into chapter 9. So in this, he's now answering the question, what advantage, when you've worked your whole life, what's left in your hand? Not money, not all the places you've seen, because it's always, I want to see something else. I want to hear something else. He said in chapter 1, the eye is never filled with seeing and the ear is never filled with hearing. There's never enough. We want to break the monotony of life. I want to take my next trip. I want to go here. I want to go do. If I just can buy one more thing. We were having a conversation about someone very close to us who's going to buy a new truck, I think. He's got 8,000 miles on his old one and he needs a new one. I've been there. I have been there where the next new gadget that comes out on a car, I got to get one of those. So we sometimes lose sight of what's critical. Let's, chapter 9. Charles, would you lead us in prayer, please? Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I'm going to read the first six verses, and we'll take a look at those collectively. Chapter 9, Ecclesiastes, verse 1 through 6. For I have taken all of this to heart, everything that he thought about, he had seen, everything he's putting together in his mind, and explained that that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hands of God. He's going to tell you what he's talking about in a moment. Man does not know whether it will be loved or hated. Anything awaits him. Now, I want to just ask you a question, because this is where we've been in this text, and we're going to be there again in a moment. Under the sun, right down here, this is what he's calling under the sun. Is there anything that happens to a human being on earth that makes you know for sure that God loves you or God hates you? Is there anything that you can see with your eye while you're living here under the sun on this earth that makes you know exactly what your status is with God? Now, Solomon will say, no, you don't have any proof. So where is the proof that you have? What makes us come to church? And what makes us try to live right? Where does that information come from? Absolutely. And where does the promise come from? From God. So up here, from God's word that he has revealed, is how we know what happens when a person dies. What happens after death. Whether God approves us or doesn't approve us. But you would not see that, a person that lives here. So in verse 1, he's making the point. Under the sun, you don't really have any data. If you don't have something from up here helping you understand God, you have no idea whether he loves you or hates you. Look in verse 2. It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and the wicked, for the good and for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and the one who does not offer sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. In what context is that true, where every single human being is treated exactly the same on this earth? Do you believe if you did an exhaustive study of how long people live, that you could prove that godly people always lived longer than ungodly people? Could you prove that godly people across the board always went to the doctor less and had less things wrong with them? I'm going to tell you, it's not how God does his business. Look a little further. This is sometimes why we don't understand what's happening in the world around us. In verse 3, there's an evil that is done under the sun. But there's one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the Son of Man are full of evil and insanity in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterward, they go to the dead. There's a whole lot of people in this world that say, because nothing's going to happen to me if I do something wrong, I don't get struck dead, the ground doesn't open up and suck me into it, and so I'm going to just do evil. And it doesn't make any difference. He says in this, verse 5, for the living no, they will die. But the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for the memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, their zeal has already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. There's an evil that he says that all men are treated exactly the same. They have the same fate. Everybody dies. In what context? Under the sun. Now, the difference between the wise man and the righteous man is he knows he's going to die. Now, what do you think that means? What does it mean? Preparing. So, Solomon, in the book of Proverbs, twice talks about an ant. And an ant, who doesn't have a very big head, is smart enough to know that winter comes every year. And an ant, or I've told you about my little squirrel. It could have been 20 of them. They may look the same, but I think it's one. For several years, would collect those nuts, and then he would spit them out right there by that 20-mile-an-hour sign. And then in the winter time, what do you think he would do? He or she, I can't tell the difference in a female squirrel and a male, dig them up. God put in the brains of animals, prepare. There's going to be bad times coming. So when you like to take a look in chapter 5, the living know they will die. So you make preparations. You make plan for what happens after you die. But in verse 5, but the dead, the people that are spiritually dead, what does he say? They don't know anything. Nor have they any longer a reward. They just die. They're like a dog. They're like a cow. When they die, they're just dead. And they no longer participate in this thing that we call under the sun. And that's all there is to them. Unfortunately, those of you sitting here have read your Bible enough to know that there's more to your who you are than just the 60 to 90 years that you live under the sun. There's more to it. That's why the wise man, the living, the person that's spiritual living recognizes that he's going to spend and she's going to spend a lot longer than 60, 80, 90 years someplace. Now take a look in chapter 9 now, in verse 7. So then, and this will be the seventh summation statement, if you're writing those down. So then, he says in verse 7, go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. In verse 8, let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking from your head. Now in verse 7 and 8, he's starting to move into, this is what you ought to get. So back in verse 7, let me just say this. Solomon has a lot to say about wine. So before you just say, oh, that's the passage I'm going to use to drink, you need to go back and just do a little research in Proverbs on everything Solomon said about wine. And you'll get a little different view. Smooth, but it stings like an adder. That's what Solomon says. You wake up and you got bruises and you got beaten places and you don't even remember what happened. That's Proverbs 20, Proverbs 26, 27. But at any rate, because there are things in life I can't fix. There are things in life I don't have any control of. I remember seeing a quote, and I don't recall where it came from. I'm sure we could Google it. Lord, give me the sense or the ability to know what I can and cannot control. Give me the ability to know what I can fix and what I cannot fix. And if we spend less time on things out there that God has made crooked and we don't understand why, and we spend less time trying to fix other people's business, and we spend less time trying to figure out exactly what is God doing, and I just take care of my business. There are certain things that I know I'm taught throughout the entire Bible, Old and New Testament, and this comes into verse 8. What do you think the phrase means when he says in verse 8, let your clothes be white all the time? Throughout Old Testament, all the way to the Revelation, that always means one thing. Righteous. Righteous. I want you to look at Revelation chapter 6. This just happens to be my favorite passage, but he makes a point. Being clothed in white, being dressed in white. David talked about it a lot in the Psalms. In chapter 6 of the Revelation, in verse 9. Chapter 6 and verse 9. And when he broke the fifth seal, I saw under the altar of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony that they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, wilt thou refrain from judging and avenging our blood upon those amongst those on the earth? Well, let's just stop for a minute. So Solomon says, one of the hardest things to get your head around is, if God is in control, And if he providentially is caring for the world, why do I see wickedness? Why do I see oppression? Why do I see injustice? These people who have been slain because of their testimony in the Word of God, and they are around the altar of God after they have been slain. We see this picture. What are they asking? When are you going to make things right? When are you going to avenge our blood? In verse 11, and there was given to each one of them what? This is what you see throughout the wisdom literature, throughout the New Testament. You see it here in the Revelation. There was each given to them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and brethren who were being killed, even as they had been, should be completed also. Back to Ecclesiastes 9. Let your robes always be white. Do you remember Jesus came to a dinner of two sisters that were very close to him? You remember the story? This is in Luke chapter 10. One of the sisters was sitting right here at his feet and listening to him. The other one was doing what most women would want to do, and that is, I want to be a good hostess. I want to have a good meal. I want to have a clean house. I want to have these things because I love him and I want to impress him. Anybody know which one of them it was that was in the kitchen doing all the work? I've said this before, but I learned when I was a little boy, and my sisters, if your middle name was ever used by your mom and daddy, it was not good. You didn't know what was going to happen next, but if your middle name got used, because they didn't normally use it. In biblical times, it's when you say somebody's name twice. Martha, Martha. What did Jesus tell her? Because he tells her something that we struggle with. You're worried about so many things. And there are really only a few things that are important. Really only one, he said. And your sister has chosen the better. In what way? She was listening to Christ, to the Lord. She was sitting at his feet and listening to him. I would say to you, what Solomon is saying back in verse 7 and then into verse 8. Eat your bread in happiness. Learn to try to be happy. I remember seeing a long time ago, somebody had done this math, but and I'm guessing could be a total lie, but stuck in my brain. It takes a lot more muscles to frown than to smile. You ever heard anybody say that? You ever hear anybody tell you that frowning causes wrinkles? I don't have a clue if that's true or not, but it sounds good. So what Solomon says is, be happy. And part of being happy is realizing what you can change and what you can't change. And focusing on what you can and working to change that. Now, God gives me the right to, in prayer, to ask him for anything. I could ask him, the Apostle Paul did. I could ask God for all kinds of things that would be harmful to me. Do you know that the one thing that the Apostle Paul said that he prayed three times, and I don't mean three little prayers, probably three significant periods of time, that something would happen to him, God would cause something. Anybody know what it was? That his thorn in the flesh would be taken away. What he realized in time was the thorn in the flesh was given to him for a purpose, to keep me from exalting myself. 2 Corinthians 12 and 7, because, verse 7 says, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelation given to me, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger from Satan to keep me from exalting myself. And then he said, I prayed about it three times. There's a beautiful song written some years ago, Thank God for Unanswered Prayers. Paul felt that way. He realized that he was so thankful that God didn't answer his prayer. So in chapter 9 and verse 7, go then, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has approved you. In what way has he approved you? In verse 9, because you're a person who wants always your clothes to be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking from your head. Probably the most famous Psalms. Anybody want to guess what I think is, anyway, the most commonly read and quoted Psalm? Psalm 23. You know what verse 5, Psalm 23 and 5 says? Thou hast anointed my head with oil. It means that God has shown favor. God has elevated you to a significant place. You remember last week, Scott, talking about where Christians sit next to Christ? So in verse 8, let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking from your head. Enter life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward and your toil in which you have labored under the sun. So looking at these, what does he say? Number one, enjoy life as much as you can. Learn to be happy. Learn to be pleasant. Number two, let your garments be white. Do what is right in God's eyes so God will show you favor. That's what the oil is he's talking about. Number three, enjoy family. Enjoy being around family. Enjoying life. Could you imagine that a person can spend so much time working, so much time playing, so much time stressing that they don't get to enjoy what's right in front of them? The people closest to them? Now look at this for just a moment. Now the fourth one in verse 10. Whatever your hands find to do, verily do it. Do it hard. Do it with fervor. With all your might. For there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. You ever know anybody that hates work? They work because they have to, but they hate it. They hate work. They hate the thought of work. They would get out of it in a minute. Throughout all of the wisdom literature, it deals with work is a blessing. You ought to desire to work. You ought to want to have work ethic. It's part of what gives you value in this life. I have seen so many people. I have 9 months and 13 days and 4 hours till I can afford to retire. They're counting it down. They come see me later. I got 4 months and three. They know to the day when they can afford to retire. They got their everything all lined up. Well, then what happens? 6 months later, they're bored to death. I used to tell people, I believe that you can get tired of any job. Could you imagine being a taste tester for Bluebell? Do you think that one day you would get so sick of eating Bluebell ice cream you can't stand it? Keep looking. So he says, whatever you find to do in verse 10, this is the next thing, and that is work hard. Because work is a blessing and the ability to work and do something. He says, whatever your hands find to do, verse 10, this is chapter 9 and verse 10, do it with all your might, for there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. I want to go all the way back to chapter, let's go all the way back to chapter 2. Chapter 2. This is the first conclusion statement in chapter 2, verse 10. And it has to do with work. With the ability to work with your hands and make something and help make the world a better place. Chapter 2 and verse 10. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of what? My labors. My heart was pleased because of all of my labors, and this was my reward. What does he say? For my labors. So the things that I have, I learned to enjoy them because they were from God. They were a gift from God. Do you know people that, and we have some close to us, who have congestive heart failure, or young men, young women who have some major disease where they cannot work. Don't you think they would give anything to be able to work if they could? All right, let's take a look. Just a couple more things. Back to chapter 9. So chapter 9, he says, verse 11, I saw under the sun, and I'm going to pick this up on Wednesday evening. I saw under the sun, when I didn't think about God, I'm just looking at things happening on the earth. I saw under the sun that the race is not always to the swift. The fastest person doesn't always win the race. And the battle is not to the warrior. The greatest warrior doesn't always win the battle. There's a classic story about this man's daddy where the greatest warrior did not win the battle. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Goliath. One stone to the middle of his head and he dropped like a big tree. He says in verse 11, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like a fish caught in a treacherous net and a bird trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when suddenly it falls on them. I want to just leave you with this thought. Every single time something good happens to you or something bad happens to you, burning large amounts of brain cells trying to figure out what did I do right, what did I do wrong, what's going on, as if every single event in life had to do with you, with how you acted or how you reacted. Solomon's making a point, and that is there are plenty of things in life that happen because of time and chance. There's not really any way to explain it. But he deals with the very same thing, and that is just understand that not every single event in life has some long, detailed meaning to it. In some cases, it's time and chance. Any comments as we close? We're going to pick that up. Man doesn't know his time. Like a bird caught in a net or a fish on a hook. He said, you don't know your time when things happen to you. I know enough people, and many of you do too, on a daily basis, somebody says, did you hear what happened to this lady? Did you hear what happened to this guy? And some wonderful thing, but most of the time, terrible thing. Well, how'd that happen? It must have been because they lived wrong. They were living bad. Try to figure the world out through those lens. Thank you for your time.